I heartily endorse this event or product.
Ahoy, hoy, everybody. Welcome to another interview episode of Talking Simpsons. I'm one of your hosts, sodium benzoate enjoyer Bob Mackey, who's here with me today.
Egghead likes his bookie wook. It's Henry Gilbert.
Hello, Henry. And we'll be talking to the great Dan McGrath soon. Dan was with the show for a few years. He wrote episodes such as Bart of Darkness, Boy Scouts in the Hood, and also two Halloween segments. What were those? He wrote with Greg Daniels.
The Devil and Homer Simpson and Time and Punishment, two of the greatest Treehouse segments ever.
And we have to thank a friend of the show and personal friend at this point, Dan Graney, for setting us up with Dan McGrath.
Yeah, no, thank you very much, Dan Graney. Dan McGrath was super awesome, very giving of his time with us. I loved hearing not just his stories about working on, you know, seasons 4, 5, and 6 of The Simpsons, but also his time on Saturday Night Live, his work on Mission Hill, King of the Hill. He has worked on so many comedies that I'm sure fans of the show love beyond just The Simpsons.
He actually started on SNL when I started watching it way too young, and he brings up something he wrote that is still in my head today. So thank you to Dan McGrath.
Yes, yeah. And so let's get into the interview.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me here.
Yes, thanks so much for taking part in this, Dan.
My pleasure.
We wanted to start off with how you got into comedy writing before The Simpsons, before SNL. Can you talk about where you started and how you sort of landed in the world of television writing?
Frankly, it's something that I've been doing pretty much my entire life. I have an older brother who is vastly funnier than I am, and when we were kids, we used to collaborate on, like, we'd make our own comic strip, and we, like, made little Super 8 films, and we, you know, were kind of nerds and imitated Monty Python all the time and all that sort of stuff. And so I've been doing it sort of like, you know, in a kind of amateurish way pretty much since, like, the third grade, I suppose. I had a couple of different ambitions when I was, for instance, in college, but this was one of them, and this is the one that panned out, I suppose.
Was SNL your first professional comedy writing gig?
It was the first serious one. The year before I got hired at SNL, I was on this show. Actually, Bill and Josh, they kind of started with me, like, before Comedy Central existed. I don't know if you guys remember this, but there were two cable all-comedy networks. One was owned by MTV. It was called Ha. And one was called, owned by HBO, it was called The Comedy Channel. And everybody kind of knew that they were going to merge because there just wasn't a market enough for, like, two separate comedy channels, which they eventually did merge into Comedy Central, which was the smart thing to do. When, like, we both worked at this MTV Ha network, and Bill and Josh worked on this show called After Drive that was a kind of a talk show with Dennis Leary on it and Billy Kimball, and I worked on this sketch show. It was very similar to Saturday Night Live, and actually that was how I got hired at SNL. Was I sent them some of the sketches I'd written for this other show, and Jim Downey, who was the head writer at the time, like, he liked them, and so that was kind of like part of the way that I got hired there. So I started professionally, like, I guess around 1990. First, I did a year at this MTV show, and then I went over to SNL, and then from there to The Simpsons, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I never actually heard about that Ha late-night comedy program. I know Bill and Josh wrote for this Dave Thomas special. It was a parody of reality shows of that era, but I didn't know about that talk show. That's really interesting.
Yeah, no, it was very funny, actually. You know, it was like, I saw some of the, I didn't actually watch, you know, I was so busy with my own stuff, I didn't actually watch the show that often, but I got to see every so often stuff that Bill and Josh had done, and it was very funny. You know, it's like, I kind of can't describe it. It was a very avant-garde kind of show. It was a little difficult to sort of describe. It was sort of a talk. It was kind of like, I guess it was kind of a David Letterman-esque kind of thing, but it was very unusual, but very funny.
And when you wrote on SNL, that was like some of the peak years of the show. It was 90 to 92, and I don't think the show had been that hot maybe since the first years. And I'm interested in interesting celebrity stories, especially. You had, like, Nirvana, Macaulay Culkin, Patrick Swayze. All these people were on the years you worked there.
Yeah, no, it was a very exciting time, I have to say, because we had literally three casts at that point. We had the sort of veteran cast, which was like Phil Hartman, and John Lovitz had left, but we had Phil Hartman and Dana Carvey and Victoria Jackson. You know, we had that core cast. And then we had the cast that they'd been bringing up, which was Adam Sandler and Rob Schneider and Chris Farley and Timmy Meadows. And, you know, like, so we had this other second, also incredibly, David Spade, you know, also incredibly good cast. And then there was a third cast that they were kind of adding, which was a couple of Ellen Cleghorn and Siobhan Fallon and a couple of other people. It was, you know, there was this sort of like superabundance of talent. And a lot of these people wrote their own stuff. So, and we had Mike Myers, you know, it was like, so it, yeah, it was a really exciting place to be at the time. It was kind of like, I mean, that, I don't know if people have talked about it before, but that place is kind of like, it's very hyperactive. It's a very, you know, it was culture shock for me to move to The Simpsons, because Saturday Night Live was this kind of like, you were constantly in motion. You were constantly running around, you know, doing like six things at once, you know, whereas at The Simpsons, it was this very sedentary. You sat in the room with the Supreme Court judges of comedy, and you just kind of like, you know, focused on one thing at a time. And it was this very, it was, I used to say it was like an Indian sweat lodge, you know, it was like, but Saturday Night Live was like, you know, it was very chaotic. It was a lot of fun, but it was hyperactive. So they were very different sort of like corporate culture, so to speak.
I guess there is a major difference in having to put together a show in a week compared to 9 months that The Simpsons comes together.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, and it was kind of like, you know, The Simpsons is sort of like, it's delayed gratification theater, you know, it's like you have an idea and then a year later it's on the air, you know, it's like, we're Saturday night, you have an idea on Monday morning and, you know, a couple of days later it's on the air, you know, it's like, which was, it, you know, it was kind of fun, you know, it's like, but yeah, they were very different sort of like conceptual ways of, you know, thinking about, you know, I don't know how much time, you know, you could dedicate to a particular concept or particular idea, you know, and also because The Simpsons, as I'm sure you know, it's like any sort of story gets reworked over time. It keeps, every time it comes back in a different iteration as an animatic, as a color, it, you know, the staff looks at it again. Whereas, you know, with Saturday Night, like you have an idea and then it's on and then you forget about it. You move on to the next thing. You know what I mean?
Can you talk about any particular sketches you're proud of, or characters, or any way you left your mark on SNL in your years there?
I wouldn't say that I left too much of a mark on it. It was very difficult to get things on the air. The two things that I was very proud of, one was I came into the show with this character, and I suppose that, like, I got this, this is unheard of, but I came in the very first week and I got a sketch on the air. I pitched a character who was basically a repeatable character. It was this thing called Frank Gannon, PIPI, politically incorrect private investigator, you know, and it was played by Kevin Nealon. And the idea was just this, it was a private investigator, but it was kind of like a cop who sort of showed up at a crime scene and just started making really rude assumptions about everything, you know, it's like, and that was a lot of fun. I co-wrote that with Al Franken, who like did a lot of the best stuff in the sketch. It was great. I got a sketch on the air my very first week, which was like a very difficult thing to do, but it was very hard to get things on the air. And the other thing that I did that I was really proud of was a thing called Three-Legged Jeans. It was a commercial parody that Jim Signorelli directed. And it was just, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's a kind of like, it was a parody of kind of like hipster jean commercials. It was very, it had a kind of hip-hop flavor, and there were all these kind of like visual effects, and it was about these jeans that, it was three-legged jeans, they had three legs instead of two, you know, and like we were making all these like bizarre physical jokes out of that. It was a visual piece, but I was very proud of it. It came out very well.
That is a great commercial parody, and I have the song from that in my head to this day. These were your years, were the first years I started watching SNL, so a lot of this is really connecting with me.
Yeah, no, I remember writing that song. It was like I wrote the whole song, and it was missing something. And G.E. Smith came in, and he was the one who came up with that kind of a leg and a leg and a leg. You know, it was like I had the rest of the song, and it was just like, you know, I think Jim Downey was going, it's a funny song, but it's missing something. And G.E. just started going like a leg and a leg and a leg. It was like, that's it, you know, because that became like the hook or the riff to it, you know.
Good reggae flavor.
You know, it's interesting the way that people, you know, in terms of collaboration, the way that people can suddenly just jump in with something that makes the piece. You know, it's like, I think that happened a lot at The Simpsons. Like, you know, somebody would have a joke that was funny in itself, and then somebody else would sort of like just add one little thing at the end of it that made it a million times more memorable. That it would have been a funny joke, but like somebody added this next thing, and that made it sort of like, wow, now it's radioactive. You know, it was kind of like, it shows you what can happen when you have a lot of people focusing on something, you know? When you wear your Levi's three-legged jeans,
also on that Saturday Night Live writing staff, there were a lot of, you know, future Simpsons writers like Conan O'Brien and Greg Daniels, Ian Maxtone Graham. Like, what did you guys have a particular opinion of The Simpsons when it was premiering while you guys were working on SNL?
Well, you know, it's like, while we were working, I'll tell you, like, while we were working at SNL, like, you really didn't have time to engage in anything else with too much. Like when I was there at SNL, Conan and Greg had left the show, and Conan had actually come on board at The Simpsons the year before I got there. So, you know, we would occasionally see like little snippets of it, but it was the year before when I was working at MTV. That was the year that The Simpsons debuted. And when I first got into TV, because I, believe it or not, I came out of the avant-garde theater, if you can believe that. You know, that was another one of my weird ambitions, you know. And I was interested in TV only in the kind of like formally unusual things. I was interested in things like Letterman and Saturday Night Live, but like standard sitcoms, you know, things like Cheers, as well written as a thing like Cheers was. Like, I wasn't really interested in trying that. And so when The Simpsons came on, I remember seeing that first season and I fell out of my chair because I was like, and Twin Peaks debuted at the same time. And I suddenly said like, oh my God, you can really do things in episodic television. It's like, you know, because I had thought, well, my real niche is going to be one of the weirder places like SNL or Letterman or something like that. And then I saw The Simpsons and I was like, wow, look, they can do things with episodic TV that are like really elastic and really unusual. This is cool. So that first season, it really kind of opened my eyes. But then when I got to SNL, frankly, we didn't have time to do anything except the show. So you didn't really watch TV, you know, except for research. Like the only reason you would watch TV is say, we want to do a parody of the show. Well, all right, well, we'll watch the show. You know, it's like, but you didn't have time to like sit home on the couch and go like, what's on tonight? Yeah, that just, that leisure did not exist.
And I guess it was too expensive to do a Simpsons parody on SNL.
Yeah, no, there's no way. I don't think we could have done that. Yeah. I mean, actually, well, like, who knows? We didn't try. You know, it's like.
We did an interview with Bill Oakley and he had mentioned that in the move over from season 4 to 5, there were only 4 writers that stayed, and it was him, Josh Weinstein, Conan O'Brien, and yourself. And so
that's,
I was
right,
curious,
yeah,
like, when were you hired onto the Simpsons staff, like during season 4?
I came in, I'm trying to remember, I guess it must have been September of that year, because they were doing finishing takes on what I guess was season 4. We were doing, I remember one of the first things that we did was a rewrite on Clown Without Pity, which would have been from Treehouse of Horror. I don't know which number that was. So I was kind of on, I was brought on kind of at the tail end of that time. I think partly because they knew that they were going to lose a lot of their core staff because their deals were up and they're moving on to other things. And I think they were looking, you know, because the Lampoon had been such a good source of people in the past. And they were kind of like, well, I think I kind of came up on their list for that reason. But yeah, I was kind of, I'm pretty sure it was like August or September of that year.
What's it like to do a rewrite on an episode that's basically finished at that point, like the Treehouse of Horror one?
Those, like when the colors were coming in, I mean, this was my first taste of this entire production procedure, which was so, like I say, so different from how we did Saturday Night. It was kind of like a lot of those episodes were, you know, they were largely done. I was still, it took me a while to learn the level of meticulousness that the Simpsons staff, like, you know, how they paid attention to everything so carefully. You know, it's like, so I think like the two first things that we worked on when I got there, or the three first things, I remember, like, you know, the first joke that I got on the show at all was on Homer the Heretic. You know, it's like, and Clown Without Pity, I actually got a little routine in there, the whole thing about that's good, that's bad, you know, the program is also cursed, you know, but it comes from the choice of toppings, but the toppings contain sodium benzoate. That was like my pitch, you know.
Oh, that's
like,
fantastic.
Like, Jeff Martin started it, and then they couldn't figure out how to end it, and I came up with the ending for that, you know. And also, that's another one of those great moments of, you know, how people add things, because Jeff started the whole thing of like, let's do that's good, that's bad, and it was like, you know, well, it comes with your choice of toppings, you know, and they couldn't figure out how to end it, and then I said, like, well, the toppings are, the topic contain sodium benzoate, and then Homer just kind of stares at the guy, and the guy has to say, that's bad, and that sounded like the end of it, but it still didn't feel like it was over, and Al Jean was like, we need one more thing, and George Meyer jumped in with Homer going, can I go now? Which I really thought, I thought that was one of the great signature Homer lines, can I go now?
That's a great topper.
I think that kind of summarizes part of his approach to life, you know, if that makes sense.
No, waiting for someone to finish talking is very much Homer's philosophy, I think.
Yeah.
So what was your connection to the existing writers on The Simpsons staff when you joined in season 4?
Well, I had known Conan for quite some time, and I had worked with him, you know, a good deal. I was kind of like one of the junior, when he was president of the magazine, I was one of the junior executive editors, like, on his staff. So I kind of worked closely with Conan, and he was a great person to work with. I mean, Conan is just absolutely brilliant. He's one of the funniest people I've ever met. He's also just, like, a tremendously cool guy. He's just a really good guy, you know. It's like, and Bill Oakley, I had known not quite as well because he was kind of a younger guy. You know, it's like, and Josh, I knew that Josh was good friends with Bill, but I didn't really know Josh that well. So I was kind of like, you know, when I showed up on the staff, that was my first time like interacting with the two of them, you know, on a regular basis. But Tone and I had known well for quite some time.
You know, I'd love to know what that specific, like the first joke you got in there was in Home of the Heretic, but do you remember what the first joke you pitched was? And was it a little intimidating in the room?
Oh, it was certainly, it was very intimidating in the room. It was like, because not only were these, like, these, you know, these people had already made the show a legend, you know, a lot of them being these Lampoon people were legends just from the magazine. Guys like Mike Reese and Jeff Martin were legends already just from the magazine. You know, it's like, and now they were legends again from the show. And it was kind of like being, you know, a first year law student suddenly being asked to argue a case before the Supreme Court. You know, yeah, it was very intimidating. You know, it wasn't intimidating in the sense that those guys were not intimidating themselves. They weren't going out of their way to stare you down or to be difficult. It was just they had very high standards. And the other thing was that it was one of these rooms where, by and large, like, at least, you know, things changed as the staff changed, the atmosphere and the chemistry changed. But like when I first showed up there, everybody sat there very quietly, like thinking about, like Al Jean, who ran the room, would go like, all right, you know, in this scene, like, we need a better joke than the one we need, you know, Marge has to have a better blow to this scene, you know. And then everybody would just sit there and kind of meditate in this very quiet way. And then after a while, somebody would just say something out loud and nothing would happen. So you'd go like, all right, moving on. You know, and everything was done by acclamation. You know, it's like, like a joke didn't go in until somebody said something and everybody laughed. And like, once everybody laughed, it was like, now this is under consideration. But, you know, people would all the time pitch things and they would just be this kind of like, everyone would just kind of nod. And that meant, no, that's not it. You know, it's like, so yeah, but I mean, they weren't being deliberately intimidating. That wasn't their manner. But there was just this kind of like there was a kind of solemnity in that room. You know, that made it even further intimidating because people were not joshing and throwing food at each other and, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, it's Saturday Night Live, it was a circus. Yeah, you know, it's like, but, you know, this place was like, the people were like thinking very carefully. So, yeah, I guess intimidating was the word. Yeah.
There was a huge period of transition between seasons 4 and 5. Al Jean and Mike Reese left as showrunners, and it felt like maybe 75% of the current writing staff had left at that point. What was it like to be on the show at that point where I believe Bill Oakley told us it was you, Bill, Josh, and Conan just together
right, yeah,
for a long time until the show restaffed? What was that like?
Well, there was a period where, like, none of us had, like, you know, I was brand new. I had only been on the show for, like, I don't know, maybe 3 months, I suppose, when that happened. Bill and Josh were fairly new, and Conan had only been on, I think, for about a year and a half at that point. And so none of us had really any authority, either professional or moral, to make any decisions. And, you know, they were kind of, like, looking for a showrunner. They eventually settled on Dave Merkin, you know. But for a while, they, you know, they were weighing their options, I guess, and it took a while for them to, like, fill out the staff. I think first they brought in Dave, and then Dave started to hire people that he liked. It took a while for the show to get back up to working speed, but there were a couple of weeks where we really didn't have a mandate to kind of do much of anything. Like, we on our own authority, we couldn't authorize stories, or, you know, like, we didn't have the gravity to do that. So we were just kind of going, all right, well, what's going to happen next? You know, and there was this kind of, like, nervous waiting period. And then, you know, gradually the staff started to reassemble and new people came on, and then it became normal again. So, it wasn't really terrible. It was just kind of unexpected. You know, I kind of thought that, like, once all these people left, their replacements would show up, and it took a while to entice people, the right, you know, I guess the people that Dave and Jim Brooks kind of wanted, you know, it took a while to sort of, like, decide on that. And, you know, but eventually it happened.
Saturday Night Live is famous for really late night working, and how did The Simpsons writing compare to that?
Well, it was more civilized and it was more regular. I mean, put it this way, at The Simpsons, at least you could go home and sleep. You know, at Saturday Night Live, there was a period between like Monday and I guess the table read would have been on Wednesday afternoon. And there was a period between Monday and Wednesday afternoon where you basically didn't sleep. Yeah, and you didn't really leave the office. You just kind of camped out there and stayed there the entire time. You know, it's like, I don't recall, like, going home, like, during those periods. I just slept on a couch wherever I could find one. Yeah, you know, it's like, The Simpsons, at least, there was a kind of, the hours were kind of, they were long, but they weren't insane, but they kind of had a regularity to them. We started at, around, I guess, around 10 a.m., and sometimes we would go until, like, 7 or 8 p.m., and sometimes if we had a problem, we would go to, like, 11. Rarely, it was very rare to go past 11, you know. So there was, at least, even though it was like a long day, there was an expectation that you would in fact go home. You know, it's like, which was not the truth at Saturday Night. You didn't really expect to go home.
Can you remember any specific instances in which you had to stay that late? Were there any certain episodes that you had problems breaking the story, or any certain jokes you had problems nailing? I'm just curious as to if there are any instances you can remember of being there super late.
Oh yeah, well, there were always jokes that everyone has problems nailing. That kind of happens all the time. Yeah, the stories very very frequently. I imagine that people you've talked to before have described the story conferences and how that worked, where the whole staff would sort of assemble in a hotel suite and Jim Brooks would kind of come and sit in on the thing. And we would kind of like go around the room and everybody would pitch a story or two, and like, you know, one at a time. And like, you know, you would pitch something that hopefully was going to be your story for that part of the season. And once it was figured out, like what the basic nuts and bolts of the story was, the act breaks and that kind of thing, people would start jumping in and throwing in jokes and stuff like that. And then Jim Brooks would kind of decide that that story had been approved. And we had this little Chinese gong. And once Jim had kind of like given his nod of approval, somebody would hit the gong and that story was in. You know, it's like, and we'd go around the room and you kind of hoped that your story would get a gong. but basically the thing is, we had those conferences, I guess, twice a year, if I remember right. And so usually the basic architecture of the stories was worked out at that conference. And so we didn't have, I mean, you know, getting all the details and the nuts and bolts, that was always a problem. But like once we went into like pitching out a show, we kind of already knew, we had a general sense of the blueprint of what we were trying to aim for, you know, so we didn't sit around that much kind of like puzzling, going like, I don't know, what's the next act break? Like, we kind of already knew that stuff.
Dan Greaney went a bit through the difficulties of the pitching process. Did you have any pitches that you wish you'd gone through but didn't get to the gong?
I had, because I only wrote two full episodes, and I wrote two of the Halloween episodes. That was like the original stuff that I had. The very first story conference that I went to, which happened like only like, I think like 3 months after I just shown up. So I was like terrified. You know, it was like, oh my God. And the story that I pitched sank like a rock. I can't even remember what it was, but it was kind of eccentric. And people were just like, eh, no. But they kind of were like, you know, we need to give this guy a story. And I guess they had kind of in their backlog, they had a story about Bart joins the Boy Scouts, but they didn't really know what to do with it. It was just like a card on the in the room, you know. And like my story pitch just like died. But they needed to give me a story. So somebody said, like, well, why don't we get Dan the Boy Scout thing? And I said, that's great, because I was a Boy Scout, you know. So, and everybody kind of jumped in, and they kind of were, like, in the room, like, you know, it was like witches throwing things into a cauldron, you know. It's like, and it's like within, like, you know, this had been a story that they'd wanted to do, but they never knew what to do with. And they said, let's give Dan the Boy Scout story. And everybody just, like, jumped in and started, and 15 minutes later, the story was worked out.
Wow.
You know, it's like, so that was my first one. So it wasn't original with me. I added a lot of original elements to it once I started working on it. I added things that hadn't been part of it structurally at first, but you know, it the only original story that I was able to pitch there was the swimming pool episode, Bart of Darkness. That came from me, and that got the gongs. And then those were the only ones that I did.
Well, getting into Boy Scouts in the Hood, I wanted to ask, like, I love that episode. It's one of the, like, the meaner homers in that episode, and I was curious, like, what that tone that you kind of strike there with Homer, was that in your original script?
Some of it was, but it was amplified, like, by the room. It was kind of like, because part of that show was this kind of like Bart having like this ambivalent feeling towards his father, and he wasn't sure what to say, you know, especially because he got this, like, once he joined the Boy Scouts and Flanders was the Scoutmaster, and at first he didn't want to be in the Boy Scouts, but then he started to take a shine to it, and he started to sort of like admire Flanders more than he admired his father. And so there was this kind of subliminal tension between Bart and Homer, and it was kind of like, what is a son's opinion of his father? And that was kind of the subliminal texture of the whole show. That was in my original draft, but once people got their hands on it, they really cranked it up, you know. That whole thing about, I think it was Conan's line, was Egghead likes his bookie book, you know. Like, you know, Homer just mocking, you know, like, I like the there was one line that was in my original draft, made it in, was like when Homer goes like, how is jerk practice, boy, to just sing to trees and build stupid things out of wooden logs, you know. It was kind of mean, you know. It's like, but then, like, Conan, I think that was the best one, was Conan going, Egghead likes his bookie book, you know. It was just, yeah, but the people really, like, that was in there, but yeah, people really revved it up to, like, they cranked it to 11, I think.
So when did Ernest Borgnine enter the story? Was that in your original draft, or was it just a placeholder?
That was literally, I was sitting there at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I went, you know, I used to write late at night on the Fox lot. I came up with the whole thing of the celebrity dad. That was like a thing that I just invented. And I realized that, like, the Simpsons had so much clout that anybody that I just kind of like magically summoned would probably appear, you know. It's like, you know, and so I was like, you know, who's the celebrity dad? And it had to do with, I picked Ernest Borgnine because the whole thing was about father son stuff. And my own father was a kind of like, he was a sweetheart, but he was a big tough guy. And he looked a little like Ernest Borgnine, you know, and the whole thing was about this business of fathers and sons and everything. So I just said, like, I just blurted out at 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, you know, the celebrity, I'm afraid Ernest Borgnine has already been confirmed. I just made it up, you know, and sure enough, they got him. You know, it was like, and it was wonderful to think, like, I could just sit there in a room at 3 o'clock in the morning and say, Ernest Borgnine, and he magically literally appeared, you know, and he was fantastic. He was really great. So it turned out to just be a good call.
He was even okay with, like, being murdered on screen.
Yeah, did he get it? Did he get the joke?
I don't know what the joke, strictly speaking, was. It was a personal joke to me, you know, but I don't think he needed it to be explained. I think he just knew that it was, I wasn't actually at the record. I didn't get to meet him, you know,
okay.
It's like, so I don't really know what they told him, but it was a funny enough part. I think he just enjoyed it. But I don't think anybody said, like, Dan has this whole thing that you remind him of your father. You know, I don't think anybody said that to him. You know, it was a funny part, and he was a good sport. And he came and he did it. And I thought he did a great job.
He did a great job. Yeah, definitely.
You mentioned the Treehouse of Horrors. I was curious, both of your segments are co-credited to Greg Daniels. How'd that come to be?
I don't rightly know. Like, you know, we were both, you know, I'd known Greg for a long time since the magazine, obviously, also, and we were kind of friendly. And I guess what happened originally was we were trying to work, because the Treehouse of Horror episodes, unlike the other stories in the season, like, didn't get worked out in the story conference. They got pitched in the writer's room. And so we were sitting around trying to figure out what the stories were going to be and who was going to do them. And I think what happened was, I believe it was Conan who pitched the whole Homer sells his soul to the devil for a donut. And I kind of jumped in and said, oh my God, that's the devil in Daniel Webster. You know, it's like, you know, it's based on the Stephen Vincent Benet play, which I was a big fan of when I was a little kid. I was kind of like the bratty literary guy on the show at the time. You know, Dave Merkin said, why don't you do that one? Because you seem to have a line in on it. But because I was kind of a new guy and Greg was more experienced, you know, I think he just put the two of us together. I said, like, Greg, you know, why don't you help him? The two of us wound up doing that one, and we had so much fun with it. I think that episode turned out really well, and we had so much fun that when the Time and Punishment one came along, we were just assumed to be like a team for the Halloween stuff. And we enjoyed working together. It was a lot of fun. He was really great.
No, those are two of my all-time favorite Halloween ones. Like, the Devil and Homer Simpson, especially, like, there's just so many great. The hell gags are great. I also just love them hucking donuts at an old man for kicks. That's a great line.
And a rare Lionel Hutz in a Halloween segment.
Yeah. Was there a bit from there that got cut that you wished had been kept in?
I'm trying to think. There was a lot of stuff. You know, there were all kinds of things. In Devil and Homer Simpson, it actually kind of worked out mostly. I mean, like, people added a lot more jokes, like, in the room. But the structure of the thing was pretty much the way me and Greg envisioned it. I remember Time and Punishment had a lot of jokes that got cut that we really wanted, and they never made it through. There were whole sequences that me and Greg came up with that we thought were hilarious, and they didn't survive. You know, it was like the whole, I don't know if you've ever heard of the whole story of Roy, you know, that whole thing. It was a joke that I had because, you know, it's the one where Homer has the time machine, you know.
Yeah.
And every time he changes something in the past, he comes back and the present is different. And in the original draft, there was this running gag where, like, every time he comes back, he no longer has a son named Bart, like the energetic, lovable Bart. Instead, he has this droopy older son named Roy, who's just a completely unlovable sort of, like, and it's just like, here's your son, Roy. And Homer keeps going, like, well, where's Bart? And Marge would go, like, I don't know who Bart is. I don't know who you're talking about. Like, aren't you taking your son to work? It's take your son to work day. Well, who's my son? Roy. And Roy was like, hi, Dad. You know, it's like, and he was just this droopy, miserable kid, you know. And Homer was like, where's Bart? God damn it. You know, and that was a thing that it got lost in the wash. Me and Greg loved it, but, like, I think other people were scratching their heads going, what's going on here, you know?
I was going to say, Bill and Josh brought a character named Roy into the fold for an episode. So a very different character. Maybe they just like the name Roy based on your pitch.
It was kind of an echo of the Roy became like a subterranean joke, like among the staff, you know, it's like, and when they did it, I forget how they did it, but, like, it was just, they were kind of like, I think it was a different character, but they deliberately named him Roy as a kind of, like, it was like a little subliminal tribute to the original Roy. It was like, it was just a funny little inside joke.
Oh, also in Time and Punishment, I saw in the deleted scenes, one was that their house turned into a squirrel house, and the artist actually drew a house made of squirrels. Was that in your original script, too?
I can't remember if that one was. I mean, we came up with the idea of just doing this montage of one house after another. You know, it's like, you know, the original idea of there being like one weird house after another, just all the changes. But I think the staff kind of got, you know, I think there was a Flintstones house, and I can't remember all of them. I think only about half of them were the ones that me and Greg came up with. And I think it might have been that the animation people just did the squirrel one on their own, and that's possible, you know. I don't recall that part.
So you were working on the show during the 1994 Northridge earthquake when that happened, and that had a major effect on the end of season 5 and especially Bart of Darkness. Can you talk about what it was like to be on the staff during that time?
You know, it was kind of weird because because I wasn't there at the for the actual earthquake. I was not present. I was in New York for some reason at the time. I'm from New York City originally. And I was working, I believe, I want to say I was working on Time and Punishment. I was writing part of the draft for that. And the earthquake happened, and I wasn't in town. And by the time I got back, it was just the aftershocks, you know. And so I didn't get the full experience of the whole thing. So I couldn't really speak to that much.
Oh, okay. Because it definitely delayed the, like, airing. It made it a season 6 in air order, even though, like, that one was intended to be the season finale or something, I think, right? Bart of Darkness?
That opened, like, the following season. It was written during, I guess, season 5, but they held it over. And I believe it was the opening, the premiere for season 6, if I'm not mistaken. That was just a kind of, like, quirk of animation. As I'm sure you've known from doing the show, it's like these shows take longer than a year to do, and so, like, there's a weird, like, they don't overlap exactly in the way that they're, it's a complicated quirk of scheduling and what the network wants and stuff like that. I don't think we had much say in the matter.
I love Bart of Darkness. It's such, like, Bob and me were both kids who did not go outside during the summer, so
it's true.
It spoke to us. As I think I actually was Bart's age when that episode aired, or close to it. I also really love the pool mobile. That was pretty great too. Was that one of your additions?
Yeah, that was me. You know, that was actually really funny because I wrote the pool mobile, and it was this whole, I don't know, it was just like the introduction to the whole concept. It was like an act 1, what we used to call an on-ramp. Like, a lot of times for act 1, we made all of act 1 like an on-ramp. You know, it's like, and the story didn't really start until act 2. And the pool mobile was the on-ramp, you know. And I was very fond of it. And I remember at one point, this was one of my bullshit things, because I grew up in Brooklyn. I was kind of more of an urban. A lot of the guys on the staff were like suburban kind of guys. And I grew up, like, in Brooklyn before it was happy, like, back when it was, like, kind of gritty working class place, you know. It's like, and this was one of my great bluffs, because we used to have these things that would come around. There was a bookmobile, there was a movie mobile, there were all these, like, trucks that would come around, too. The city had all these weird programs for the youth, you know, like, they had this idea that they had to reach out to the youth, you know. So we were always having, like, the bookmobile and the movie mobile, and various truckmobiles would show up, you know. So I just made up the poolmobile, you know, and I really wanted it in the show because I thought it was so funny. And Matt Groening was in there one day, and he was just kind of skeptical. He was like, I don't know, is there really a poolmobile? I mean, like, it sounds like it would be very impractical to drive a truck around with that much water. And I just bluffed. I said, yes, there was a poolmobile. It came to my block. I was in it. I swam in the pool. I just lied. I was like, but I kind of, like, used my New York City street cred card to just lie. And he was like, all right, if you say so. And so it stayed in the... But that was, like, one time when I just flat out lied because the poolmobile did not exist. I just wanted it to be in the show so much.
So is anything else from Bart of Darkness based on your childhood?
Oh, yeah. You know, there was a lot of stuff. The episodes that I wrote, a lot of times, like, it's not like the major story stuff, but the little jokes, a lot of them were things that I sort of, like, saw growing up. It was, like, they were all based on, like, odd little incidents. And there was one, there was in Bart of Darkness, when the ice cream guy, when Bart and Lisa are, like, in the beginning, they're kind of wilting from the heat, and the ice cream guy, and they can't get, everything keeps letting them down, you know. It's like, and the ice cream guy comes down and goes, ice cream, we're safe. And he goes, ice cream, I'm all out of ice cream. I'm fresh out of ice cream. I got no ice cream. And that actually happened. It's like, because where I was growing up, there was this guy who would come down. He was an ice cream guy. He would come down the street every night when I was like 10 years old. He had a Good Humor bicycle. Like, he didn't drive a truck. It was a bicycle with a refrigerated sort of like cabin in the front. You know, he was an alcoholic, and there was a bar on the corner of my block, and our street apparently was the last street on his route, and he was really just trying to get to the corner so he could lock up the ice cream thing and go in the bar and get sozzled, you know. It's like, and I think he was a little flushed, like, coming down the street, and every night he would come down ringing the bell, and we'd all come running out to get ice cream, and he'd open up the thing, and he was out of ice cream. He didn't have any, because, you know, he was the last block. He'd already said, he'd go, oh, look at that, I got no ice cream. And he did this, and we would go, like, we don't mind that you don't have any ice cream, but why did you ring the bell? You know, that was what drove us crazy, you know. It's like, you brought us out here, and you go, I got dark, and he did it every night, and we fell for it every night. Like, you'd think after a while we'd learn and go, like, the guy's going to ring the bell, going to run out, and he's not going to have any ice cream, but we just kept going thinking he was going to have ice cream, and he never did, you know. It's like, so anyway, I just thought that was kind of like, it was this little Kafka-esque situation from childhood, you know.
Like, you worked on other animated series, like Mission Hill and King of the Hill. I was curious, like, what did those production experiences compare to working on The Simpsons?
Well, they were very similar, actually, because there was so much overlap. I mean, I think you're talking about Mission Hill and then later King of the Hill, which were both obviously started by Simpsons alums, you know, who brought with them their kind of understanding of the kind of, like, there's a Fox/Film Roman sort of production strategy that evolved at the Simpsons, and then, you know, because so many of these shows were, like, done by Simpsons alums, it's like they kind of brought with them that production style. So Mission Hill was very, you know, it was very similar in a lot of ways to The Simpsons, but it wasn't quite as, we only had a 13-episode order when it started, and Bill and Josh kind of hired a lot of people. It was a lot more sort of like En Familia, you know, because they hired people that they were very comfortable with, and we kind of adopted The Simpsons strategies in a lot of ways, but there was something a lot more comfortable about it because it was a smaller scale. You know, it wasn't under a microscope. The, you know, Simpsons was a national phenomenon. Mission Hill was just kind of like a thing we were hoping would become a national phenomenon. I really loved that show, and I was very sad that it didn't fly. You know, it's like, yeah, it was very similar in terms of the production strategies were very similar because so many of us had that in common.
Yeah, no, Mission Hill was such an underappreciated show. I mean, I was there for the first episodes it aired, but even I couldn't keep up with it. They pretty much never aired it until it went on Adult Swim. Have you seen that it's kind of gotten a bit... at least a bit of a second life, or it got finally seen by the audience it was intended to be seen?
Yeah, I was pleased that people finally got to see it because I wrote, out of the 13 episodes, I wrote three of them, which was like roughly like almost close to like a quarter of the entire series I wrote. You know, it's like, and all my episodes were like late in the order. And when it originally aired on WB, I think it got canceled after like episode 4, I believe. They just didn't give it a chance at all, you know? And so I was just really down because like, I thought some of the Mission Hill episodes that I thought it was some of my best work that I've ever done. Like, you know, I Married a Gay Man from Outer Space is like maybe the thing I'm proudest of, you know, in the business. And Hot for Weirdy, like the Eunice Uhlmeyer character, I just love the way that came out, you know. And I was really desolate that it wasn't going to air. And then when Adult Swim picked it up, it got an audience. You know, it didn't become a smash hit. But, you know, people, like the kind of people who it was written for, seemed to find it. And, you know, they got a chance to watch it. And, like, you know, and all my, like, late in the order episodes actually got to be aired, and you know it came out on DVD and stuff. It wasn't a huge hit, and I was very afraid that it didn't, you know, that it didn't take off. I thought it was terrific, and I remember, and we were all very happy. Like one of the things about that show was Bill and Josh set up an atmosphere that was very similar in a way to like one of those like internet startup companies at the time. It was kind of a fun, this was like a new concept in corporations at the time, which, you know, everything used to be like very dreary. I mean, I don't know if people have described what the Simpsons workrooms were like, but they weren't fun places. You know, it's like the furniture was broken, and you know, Bill and Josh kind of like went out of their way to set up this like very pleasant atmosphere to do the show, and we all believed in it, we all loved it. And I remember talking to one of the writers, and we were both talking about how great everything was going, and we looked at each other and said, "We're dead, aren't we? This is just too good to be true. Like, you know, this is just too much fun. It can't possibly last." And sure enough, that's what happened, unfortunately.
I want to talk a bit about King of the Hill. You actually wrote a few of my favorite latter era episodes, like...
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. Be True to Your Fool and Full Metal Dust Jacket. I love Dale Gribble and Peggy Hill. They're some of my favorite characters on TV. So yeah, your episodes are really amazing. And I want to talk about, like, how did you get on the King of the Hill, and what was the writing process for that like, especially as someone who grew up in a very different environment than the Midwest?
Yeah, no, that's kind of interesting. Yeah, I had this kind of like, I made an effort to sort of like be a bit of a chameleon or a ventriloquist, because, you know, it's like, I wrote things, you know, it's like The Simpsons was set in like ostensibly a small town, but really kind of a suburban environment, you know. So I had to kind of stretch myself to sort of like understand what that was like. And then I worked for a while on the PJs, and that was kind of like, you know, in a housing project. And I had to sort of like stretch to sort of like do that. And so by the time that King of the Hill came along, I was kind of like, well, I'll just kind of like figure out a way to sort of like get inside of these people, you know. And I just kind of made an effort, and I hope it sort of like worked. I kind of think it did. I mean, if you like the episodes, then I'm gratified. That's the main thing, is that people enjoy them.
I really did. Is there a particular character that you liked writing for or pitching stories for in your years on the show?
Yeah, you know, that's kind of funny. I think I kind of, I gravitated to Bill and Dale, you know. It's like, I don't think I ever wrote a Bobby-centric episode, and I never really wrote, I certainly didn't write it. Well, the Peggy one, I guess Full Metal Dust Jacket was a Peggy episode, but that wasn't how I conceived it. I conceived it as the joke of somebody opens a bookstore in a small town in Texas and nobody buys books. And so somebody will start selling guns in the back to, like, make the rent. And, the, you know, everybody buys the... To me, the whole thing revolved around Peggy had a son that said it started out as Peggy's World of Books and then it became Peggy's World of Books and Guns, you know, like... And that, to me, was the joke. But I didn't think of it as a Peggy episode, per se. I kind of gravitated towards Bill and Dale, I suppose. I wrote a lot of episodes about the two of them. And a lot of people, you know, I'm just kind of, like, toot my own horn, I suppose, for a second. But I remember one time I was sitting in the room and I was like, I was frequently, like, even though I liked Hank, it was like I was frequently mad at the way he treated Bobby. I was kind of like, I suppose I have my own issues, you know. And I went on this tirade one day and I was just kind of like cursing out Hank. I was just, he's such a dick, you know. It's like, and I got really mad at Hank for some reason. And one of the other writers, they stopped me and said, I'm really surprised to hear you say that. And I said, why? And the other writer said, because I think you write Hank better than anybody else on the show, you know. It was like, I mean, so that was kind of a nice compliment. It was kind of weird, but like, I never thought of myself as a guy who wrote Hank, but I guess certain lines that I had for him were just like, I think I did tend to get inside his head in certain ways.
Yeah, maybe.
It's just kind of, I suppose I have my own issues.
Maybe you hate him because you truly understand him.
I wouldn't claim that. You know, it's just like, I think maybe on some weird Jungian subconscious level, maybe, but like, I wouldn't claim that I'm the expert on Hank, you know.
No, me and Bob were just going over that Be True to Your Fool episode and just the great moment of Hank breaking the rules to get into jail, to get arrested.
Oh, yeah.
It's so funny.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, he was trying to get arrested. He was doing all these really lame things, right? Yeah. It was like, yeah. I think that was somebody else's pitch, to be honest. I don't think that was original with me, but I thought it was very funny. You know, it's like, you know, people throw things in all the time, and, you know, that's how the thing grows. You start out with a basic kernel, and then other people go, oh, I get it, and they start throwing other things in, and before you know it, it's gotten much bigger, you know?
You know what? That takes me back to The Simpsons real quick. This was something Dan Graney really went into with us, too, was just how the name on the episode kind of makes it so you don't know who wrote all the other jokes in it. So I am curious, like, what are a couple of jokes from your time on The Simpsons in episodes you weren't the writer of that you were really proud of getting in?
Oh, well, I'll tell you one very specifically, because I thought of this, because I kind of figured your audience kind of like likes to hear these things. And I can give you a rundown of the whole Who Needs the Quickie Mart, like that musical number from Homer and Apu, which I think is pretty popular. I think people pretty much like that stuff. And I was kind of proud of it because I sort of got the ball rolling with that. I can give you like an anatomy of how that, if it's interesting to your audience, I can give you like a kind of detailed anatomy of how that sequence came about, which I think is interesting because it illustrates like the importance of like a room dynamic. You know, what happened was Greg Daniels wrote the original script for that. And in his first draft, he kind of soft-pedaled I mean, it was very funny, but it was kind of like he didn't like swing hard at it, was the bit of Apu moving into the Simpsons' house and kind of pretending that he was happy and he felt welcomed. And then Greg had this great moment where, like, and Homer was like, well, I guess that's that. This is all wrapped up. Apu's with us and he's happy and we're done, you know? And then he cut to, like, Apu sitting on the roof of the house singing this kind of plaintive song about how he missed the Quickie Mart, you know? Mm. And it actually wasn't really played for comedy. It was like genuinely plaintive, and it was kind of a cool, I believe it was the act break. It ended not on a funny note, but on a kind of, like, really sort of, like, set the story in motion. It was very well done, you know? But it was very soft pedal. It was subtle, you know? Like, mm-hmm. When we were in the room doing the rewrite of it, Dave Merkin, I believe, said, you know, we're missing an opportunity here. The whole idea of Apu kind of like coming and being welcomed in and then this kind of turnaround where he, like, you know, he's holding something back. It's like, I think we can make a big moment out of that. And so he said, like, I think we should do like a big, we should make this to a musical number about the dynamic of all this stuff. So we said, great. I think it was like 9 o'clock at night. And we were like, great, we're going to be here all night writing an ensemble song for the entire cast. It's like, and we sat there, I think, for like, maybe 45 minutes, just kind of like staring at the floor going, how are we going to do this, you know? And I got the ball rolling. I'm like, I'll give you my version of it. I think my recollection is pretty accurate. I mean, somebody else might beg to differ, I'm not sure, but I think this is pretty accurate. We were sitting there, and I was a big fan of Rex Harrison patter songs, you know, the guy who played like Dr. Doolittle, because he didn't actually kind of sing. He sort of recited the lyrics in like a melodious way. He didn't like, imagine cheating with a cheetah, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, he didn't really sing, you know. So I kind of started pitching this thing of Apu doing like a Rex Harrison patter song going like, be it igloo hut or teepee or a geodesic dome, there's no structure I have been to that I'd rather call my home. It was very Rex Harrison to me, you know. It's like, and George Meyer said, like, he leaped in on it and he said, that's great, but you missed something. You missed a rhyme. It's like, instead of be it igloo hut or teepee, it's be it igloo hut or lean to, because that rhymes with no structure that I've been to, you know. I was like, oh, yeah, you're right. You know, it's like, so it was like somebody immediately like jumped in and like already it was improved like within 30 seconds, you know. So then I said, like, you know, we didn't really have the form of the rest of the song. And I said, like, because I used to pitch scenarios sometimes instead of like direct lines. I said, well, okay, then Apu starts reciting things about the attributes of the family that he admires, you know. And so I came out with Maggie with her eyes so bright, marked with hair by Frank Lloyd Wright, you know, and Dave Merkin then just jumped right on top with Lisa can philosophize, Bart's adept at spinning lies, you know. And then everybody started jumping in on the whole thing and said, I don't know who had the salmonella line, you know. And then it became this free-for-all of everybody jumping in, you know, and just, you know, one-upping each other. And it was great. It was like, and we got the whole thing done. We kind of thought, God, we're going to be here until tomorrow morning. You know, it's like, and after it, I got the ball rolling. It's like everybody kind of jumped in, and we had the song fairly quickly, you know. It's like, so it was kind of like a really nice example of like a group dynamic, but I kind of took some pride in it because I was the one who threw the first firecracker, you know.
Who was actually writing the music during that time? I know Jeff Martin did.
It was Alf Clausen wrote
okay,
all the music.
Got it.
I think sometimes guys like Jeff and Ken Keeler are very musical, and it's possible that they had an idea of what they had in mind, but Alf Clausen would write it, and he usually understood exactly what we were going for, and he was just really great. So
Right. We
kind of like wrote the lyrics and left it to Alf, you know, and he would work his magic.
You know, I was just going through this other show because it just got released on Blu-ray, but Gravity Falls, you're one of several Simpsons alums who worked on that show in the first season. I'm curious, how did that come to be?
Oh, that's a complicated question. I don't know that I can give you an answer to that is like so to speak like photogenic. I don't think I can give you an answer that can be like articulated like clearly. You know, so that might be one of those questions I'm going to have to take a pass on. It was kind of a strange. The whole situation. I mean, I thought the show was great. I met with Alex, and he had already made like a sort of mini pilot of the show, and they showed it to me, and I was like, "This is hilarious!" You know, like what happened originally was Disney kind of like proceeds with staffing very cautiously, and they brought me in because they were having trouble with one particular episode. They were in pre-production, and Alex had already made like a mini pilot, but then they were right; they hadn't done the full pilot for the full script for the pilot. They had moved on to individual episodes. And they were having trouble cracking the nut with one of these episodes. And they just called me up. I don't know how, but they called me up and they asked me to come in and just kind of like do a diagnostic on what was wrong with the whole thing. You know, it's like why it wasn't working. And so I came in kind of as a script doctor, and I read the script with them, and I just sort of walked them through, this is not working because this, I don't understand that. And I kind of like did like a medical diagnosis of the whole thing, you know. And at the time, that was all they wanted was like somebody's an outside opinion, you know. And then I kind of left, you know, and I was having lunch about an hour later, and I had like two more new ideas, and I called up Alex like back at the office, and I said, you know, it just occurs to me that this, that, and the other thing. And Alex said, like, stop, forget it, we're bringing you on. You know, it was like, you know, I guess they just liked what I had to say, you know. It's like, so it was kind of cool. It was, and that was a really, that was, a, I think, turned out terrific. It's all Alex's vision, to be perfectly honest. You know, it's like, I thought that turned out really well.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to Mission Hill real quick because I am a gay guy and I really did love the Plan 9 from Outer Space episode. It was just such a funny idea that, like, you just have this great tribute to Plan 9 from Outer Space, but then it's also, what if Tor Johnson fell in love with a man working on the movie? Where did all that come from?
You know, that was one of those, that entire episode came to me like a bolt from the blue. The entire episode kind of appeared to me like as a vision. I had the whole thing worked out in like 30 seconds. And, you know, it's like, I guess it must have been because it was like, it's about like Wally's relationship with Kevin, and it's kind of Cinema Paradiso kind of thing, and I'm a movie nut, so it was like, oh, you can work in all these movie parodies, and then you go back in time to explore Gus and Wally's, like, their initial romance and how they fell in love, and the sacrifice that Wally makes, and then you go back to the present, and then you do the actual movie, and you have Wally being sort of mocked and humiliated, and then, yeah, you know, it's like, the whole thing came to me in, like, 30 seconds. I was so pleased, you know, and it just made complete sense, and I pitched it to Bill and Josh, and they were like, yes, bullseye, you know, it's like, and so we were all, like, you know, dedicated to, like, that was the one that we were ready to kill for, you know, like to get that on the air. It was like a flash of lightning. I was very pleased.
So we're almost out of time, Dan. Can you tell us what you're working on these days and if you have anything you'd like to plug for our audience?
Oh, yeah, no, I certainly do have something I'd like to plug, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go for it.
One of the reasons I came back to New York is to work with this, there's this young writer that I'm working with, and I'm sort of transitioning out of comedy right now and into hour-long cable, which is where all the action is, really, I think. You know, it's like, and so the two of us are doing a modern-day update. It's going to be a series instead of a feature film, but we're doing a modern-day adaptation of Metropolis by Fritz Lang.
Oh, that sounds great.
And we're kind of like taking that the original premise of Metropolis and kind of extrapolating it into, and I'm very excited about it. And we're doing a lot of, it's set about 80 to 100 years in the future of this country, and we're doing a lot of work of extrapolating, like, what the politics will be like and what the social, like, you know, a lot of it has to do with what technology and automation are going to do to society, you know, because the original Metropolis has this kind of, like, Marxian, you know, with the downtrodden workers and everything. But the reality is that automation is going to make those questions turned on their head. And so we're playing with all these questions, and it's all, like, we haven't finished the pilot script yet, but, you know, I think it's going to be a really fun project. I think it's very interesting.
Oh, that sounds great. Are you on Twitter? Are you on any of those things?
No, I tend to stay off social media. Mm. Like, I think I'm too old for it. You know, it's like, I'm not sure I understand it, so I'm not on Facebook, I'm not on Twitter, none of those things. Like, maybe one of these days, like, Twitter might be the only thing that I can sort of, like, that I could manage, because it's short, you know. It's like, Facebook, I think, is already, like, I'm an old fart when it comes to that stuff. You know, I'm a caveman.
You are, you know? You are missing thousands of people posting your jokes online every day, though.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, yeah? Oh, well, I'm glad. You know, I'm glad to hear it. You know, it's like, I mean, I think I said to Henry, like, when we first started talking, it's like, one of the things that's really nice about having had the privilege to do shows that were, A, so good, and also had so much exposure, was that the work that you do actually gets out to the world and people enjoy it. And people, like, that's the kind of, like, that's the main thing with being an artist, is making a connection with people, you know. And when you think about things like Mission Hill, or there's certain things that I worked on that never saw the light of day, you know, it's like, and I worked really hard on them and nobody knows about them, you know. It's like, so when you have something where, like, it actually gets out there and you actually do have an audience and people actually like it and respond to it, it's very gratifying. It's like, you know, I'm you know, my main thing is I'm pleased that people enjoy it.
Well, we definitely do.
Hell yeah, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So thanks so much for joining us, Dan. Thanks for your time. So many great stories.
Okay, well, thanks very much. Thanks again for inviting me, and I had a blast sort of, like, talking about it, and I hope your audience, like, enjoys, like, at least a fraction of what I had to say.
So thanks again to Dan McGrath. We usually tell people to tweet at the people we interview, but Dan is not on Twitter. So just say a prayer for Dan McGrath or something like that.
Yeah.
Write his name on a wall somewhere.
And keep an eye out for that show he's working on. But we super, super thankful to have Dan talk to us. We've talked to a lot of the showrunners, but it's really cool to talk to guys who were writers on staff.
Infantry, if you will.
Yeah. That Dan Graney directed us. Like, you guys should interview more of these guys. And just to hear, you know, I especially love McGrath's memory of jokes, of just like, oh, this person pitched this, then this person pitched this,
yeah.
And just like, or remembering his first pitch in a writer's room.
And as always, I believe all of these Simpsons writers are way too humble. They should all have huge egos. I would, but
yeah,
so nice and so gracious. So many great stories. Thanks again to Dan McGrath. And this is actually, what, our 13th interview? We've done so many of these. I'm proud of us.
Yes, yeah.
For getting all these great interviews.
Now,
mainly Henry's getting them.
No, we did it together.
It's true.
But Dan McGrath, I would just say, he really, if he was on Twitter, he'd be seeing all the people making memes out of his jokes for Simpsons shitposting.
Yeah.
But, anyway, yeah, we've got this another cool interview. If you guys haven't heard our previous interviews, you should go back through them on the Patreon. And
yes, just click the little interview tag,
yes,
and it'll load all of them. We talked to people like Henry. Name a few of the people we talked to. They should listen to
David Silverman, longtime series director for The Simpsons. Mike Reese, who was a showrunner for seasons 3 and 4, but has been writing for the show since the first season. Bill Oakley, and we need to get back in with Bill Oakley again just to talk to him about his now Instagram fame as a food reviewer.
Yeah, screw The Simpsons. It's all about eating burgers on camera now.
I can watch him eat burgers all day.
We have very differing opinions on space meat, though. But thank you so much for listening, folks. We will see you again with another interview very soon. Thank you.
Ice cream! Ice cream! Fresh shot ice cream!